from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum next in the hour ahead, famed American author Robert Coover will join us for our first half hour to discuss the novel sequel to The Origin of the Brunas, which appeared back in 1966. Then local fiction writer and former lawyer Catherine Ma will be our guest discussing her latest novel, an adopted daughter's search for identity titled The Year She Left Us. Forum is next. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Award-winning novelist Robert Coover is back with The Brunas' Day of Wrath, the long-awaited 1,000-page sequel to his 1966 classic, a William Faulkner Award-winning novel, The Origin of the Brunas, which is about a man who survives a coal mine explosion and starts an end-of-the-world cult. Author of some 14 novels and three short works of short fiction, Robert Coover is Professor Emeritus of Literary Arts at Brown University and joins us for this Forum segment to discuss his new novel and his writing career. And Robert Coover, delighted to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael. Glad to be here.
Good morning to you. I guess I want to set the stage a little bit for listeners. This is West Condon, we're talking about, a Midwest coal town where the Brunas return to a fallen economy, and there's a great deal of agitation at the return of these Pentecostals who believe in the rapture and are at odds with the whole town. It took you quite a while to come back to the story, I guess it was kind of gestating all these decades.
It has indeed been gestating. Yeah, I got the idea for it when I was writing Origin, and that's already 50 years ago. So it was a sketchy idea. I didn't have the details, but I knew basically I wanted to come back and look at this upstart cult after it had become something like a established religion. And that was an ambition that I carried along through the decades. And in the 80s, I worked pretty hard on it for a little while and then more or less abandoned it. I basically work with very unconventional material, and this was quite conventional, and I left it on a bottom shelf for a little while until I ended up until we all ended up with young Bush as our president, and out of the background emerged these Pentecostals, these evangelicals. And I thought if I was ever going to confront that issue again, this was the time to do it. So it was back in the early part of this millennium that I returned to it in earnest.
Well, notwithstanding the notion of unconventional material, there is a kind of trajectory that one finds between a cult often turning into a religion. I mean, one doesn't necessarily fit Jonestown or Waco, which I remember thinking largely of in connection with your first novel here. But this is indeed what happens. And, you know, one of the things that I admire in the work is these are kind of regular people in many ways. I mean, they're not you don't present them with a demonic brush.
No, that was a challenge. I'm a little uncomfortable with their rhetoric, but I had to sort of bury myself in it and believe as they believed. So I do have a lot of religious types, from the most simple and direct and honest to the most manipulative, and they're all at work in the book. And it was, I suppose, that one of the hardest things was to face, in terms of getting started, getting the book going, was to get up the energy, you might say, to write in their voices. And it was pretty sluggish start until along came Wesley Edwards and his passion, his kind of unconventional, out of the ordinary event, was able to break the resistance I had and set me off.
When I talk about the ordinariness and the niceness, I'm obviously excluding the Blaurock family and other characters that appear in the book like that. But you have a really range of characters here. It's and also a lot of the book is about class division, is it not?
About
class divisions.
A class division. Yes, it is. Well, of course, it's a mining community, and I spent my kind of formative teenage years in such a place, and the focus was on the relationship between the unions and the rest of the world, and that class orientation, it was kind of endemic to the mining community. So it once I decided that it would begin with a mine disaster, the origin of the Brunus, and involve a rescued miner who was going to be at the heart of the cultic development, and he himself, a Catholic, a former Catholic, ex-Catholic, surrounded by evangelical Protestant types, I had no option but to live inside these class differences.
Talking with Robert Coover, whose latest book is The Brunus Day of Wrath, and the character, the prophet, Giovanni Bruno, always brought to mind a little bit, at least, a character in a novel by Jerzy Kosinski, Being There. I mean, he utters things that sound profound, and they're really not.
My feeling about Bruno himself, the character, was that I wanted a kind of empty vehicle, a kind of an empty glass that I could fill myself, or that the people around him would be filling. That is, most of these cultic developments, a lot of them begin around a kind of mystification of a personality, and I wanted to have that quality. So Giovanni himself has a kind of blankness to his upbringing. If you see an origin, the Brunus, he's a kind of a simple boy in many ways who is excommunicated for sort of misbehavior that had to do with, dubious intelligence. And that start to life was kind of crucial to at least my vision of what these people would locate as a prophet.
You think that's often the case with some of these characters who assume these leadership roles, that people just project so many things onto them and they're like empty vessels?
Well, certainly there's a projection that takes place. The empty vessel syndrome, which I was using here, does occur often, especially if the vessel is dead, that is, doesn't have the opportunity to come up with any more material. And that means that if he's been selected and that this is the heart of your cultic belief, you've got to create what maybe wasn't there in the first place. And so therefore, yes, an empty vessel is useful. A lot of the characters start, though, I think, as I understand most religious origins, they start with something a little bit more activist, and their active role is cut short, and then that activism becomes the heart of the new cultic belief.
Talking again with Robert Coover, whose newest book is The Brunus Day of Wrath. And I must say that I think I first became acquainted with or was introduced to your work by a story which is quite famous called The Babysitter way back when. And work like some of your earlier work had you sort of put in the category of experimental. That work is a good example of that, or the avant-garde and all of that. And yet you're a realist and you remain a realist.
That's correct. I learned my realism from Kafka. He taught me everything I know.
They've been comparing this book to Moby Dick, by the way, which is not certainly a bad thing to be compared to by any stretch. But I think you were influenced a good deal by Pynchon's V with this, weren't you?
Yeah, but also Moby Dick in a different way. When I was working on Origin back in the 60s, I already was writing stories that are of the sort that appear in Prick Songs and Descants. That is to say, these metafictional stories. And that's what I wanted to do. And I didn't really want to write Origin of the Brunists, and I kept trying to find some way to get out of it. It was been into it a year or two already, and I was really wanting to get back to the good stuff, as I thought of it. And I began to try to work out ways in which I could short-circuit it a little bit. I mean, figure out a quick ending and not carry through to where I had originally thought. And that's when I chanced to pick up Moby Dick and start to read. And that experience taught me powerfully the necessity of intransigent pursuits of your metaphors, that you don't do anything halfway. That book certainly is the most intransigent pursuit of a metaphor in literary history, I think. And that was a lesson I got. I followed it, and I then really bore down on Origin, determined to make it what it ought to be. And at one point, I was living in my wife's hometown in Tarragona, Spain. We were living with a family there. And I was trying to finish that damned first book. And by now, pursuing Melville's principles, I had got myself into a kind of corner. I was writing and writing and writing. It was getting more and more boring. And I finally decided I wasn't going to do it. And I would pack it up in a box and I'd throw it under the bed and see if a year later maybe something would help. And I took to just reading and studying French and doing all sorts of odd things, writing stories especially. And a friend to whom this book is partly dedicated, Sol Urich, sent me a paperback just out then of Pynchon's V. And I had a roaring good time in it. I thought it was fantastic work. And I laughed a lot, and I realized that what had happened in my chasing the whale, I had lost my sense of humor, and that was what had to be recovered. So I pulled that box out from under the bed and threw out about 200, 300 pages and wrote what's probably the best chapter in the book, and then finished it about 60 days later.
Well, thank whatever powers it be that you moved into your humor, which is always delightful. And I like the intransigence of metaphor as a way of describing Melville's great work. We're talking to Robert Coover, if you've just joined us, by the way. And if you'd like to join us, by the way, in terms of this conversation, or if you have questions or comments for Robert Coover, if you're a reader of his, or be interested to hear from some of you who have been through cult experiences and have maybe some light to shine on that, or some thoughts at least, or reflections on that, I'd like to hear from you as well. Our toll-free number is available to you right now. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us at that toll-free number, which again is yours to use, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, which is simply kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us any thoughts you might have. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And I was struck not only by the influence of Moby Dick and V in this new work, Robert Coover, but also prompted to ask you about, well, maybe what we could call the genetic component of influence on you, because I remember I was thinking about this in conjunction particularly with Miller, the newspaper publisher, because I believe, if I'm correct, your father was a newspaper publisher and your grandfather was also a Presbyterian minister.
Close. My grandfather was a Methodist preacher, kind of a circuit rider sort. He was out in Iowa and he'd come from that kind of Palatinate Deutsch families that settled in on the East Coast in Pennsylvania, Dutchess County.
How much of an impact do those personal things have, though, really?
I don't think of them as impact, I suppose. I think of them as material, but still, that's the same thing in a certain way. I don't chase down these thoughts obsessively, but I have them as material that I've experienced and lived with. And so my grandfather's circuit rider life as a preacher in several small towns in Iowa, and my father and his siblings' consequent church roles were part of just growing up. So when one fishes for support, for a thought one has, those things help. But they don't obsess me in any way. The newspaper thing was, my father was, yes, he managed newspapers. He started with just selling ads for them and then became a newspaper manager. Not so much an editor type, just really staying on the business side mostly, but taking us, as it turned out, to this coal mining town in order to run the paper there. And that was, for me, at the age of 13, an annealing experience. It was something tough and different, and has had a, probably what one would call impact, not just a memory material, but it was an impactful time. So that I carried that through to university and wrote my first little story about a coal mine disaster. So I started, in a way, right from that early experience.
There's a coal mine disaster ongoing story in Turkey, in fact, that we've been following.
Yes.
What about the impact of say, Jonestown and Waco on this novel and its sequel?
The impact of what?
Jonestown and Waco and those kind of disasters associated with cults.
Well, I don't think it's had any impact, except it just continues to feed material. I mean, these cults rise every year. End of the world announcements are made annually, and sometimes more often than that. They may or may not follow, draw adherence to the cause. Of course, the Jones cult was one of the most notorious of them all, and the Waco story, a different kind of tale about social conflict in terms of these cults. But I don't think anything has surprised me in that arena. I think that I see it. I say, yes, I can see that. I know that's what would happen. It's my anticipation of it. I think all of the early work, early studying I did of cults like the Christian cult, for example, led me to accept certain principles about how they operate and how they grow and who tends to join them and so forth. And I did follow that very closely from the early days on of focusing on this kind of writing. So all of the consequent bad stories have gone on feeding the imagination and fueled the story material was increasingly fed by it, but not when I think impact. I think one sees something, say, "Whoa, that's not what I expected at all," and suddenly something changes and you take a new direction in what you're writing, and that hadn't happened here. I think the world just keeps revealing itself as it must, in a certain sense.
Again, we're talking to one of America's leading writers, Robert Coover. His 1966 classic, The Origin of the Brunists, was published back in 66, and now there is a sequel, The Brunist Day of Wrath, a long-awaited sequel. And this is a kind of idiosyncratic question. It's the sort of thing that sort of comes into my consciousness from time to time. Why the date April 19th? That's the holiest Brunist Day of Redemption. But why? I always wonder why authors come up with specific dates.
It actually timed out that way. If you remember the way that they get to that that date has to do with one of Bruno's pronouncements about seven Sundays, and it's from the mine disaster to the night of the sign, as they call it. Just the old man dies, but it's taken as a great sign. Is 7 weeks, and then I just counted ahead, well, where would be the next one? And that turned out to be on that particular calendar, 19 April. So it was not at all a magical number. I do use magical numbers. The book is designed The origin was designed, and this book imitates the same design. There are 33 chapters, which is the life of Christ, and plus a prologue and an epilogue. And these 33 chapters are divided into the magical numbers of 7, 7, 7, and 12, which are the dimensions, the mystical dimensions of the cross. So I use that stuff in a kind of playful way. There's quite a lot of little numerological tricks, partly generated by the cult itself. But April 19th just happened to be on the calendar as in 14th Sunday.
Could you talk a little bit? I also wonder, while we have you on the line here, I thought I would be remiss if I didn't talk with you a little bit about electronic writing, because you've been so heavily committed to that and involved in that. But can you talk a little bit about where your characters come from, especially, you know, I'm thinking about, well, some of the more dramatic characters like Darren and Sally and Billy Don, not to talk about them specifically, but generally where characters come from.
Well, I'm happy to talk about them. How does this link to electronic writing?
Well, no, I just wanted to mention that to kind of promote it, that I want to get that in before we conclude our conversation.
All right.
But I'm interested in where characters emerge for you.
I'm sorry?
Where characters emerge for you as a writer, where they come from.
Well, they often just walk on stage. I am often surprised by them. They just turn up. And now and then one invents a character and feels good about doing it. Other times they just appear unexpectedly and you have to accept them and listen to them. That aspect of characters having their own being or presence is something that most writers comment on at some point or other, that once they're invented and are fleshed out a bit and have some sort of existence. In this case, I wanted the cult, as it comes back to this area to set up its national headquarters, I wanted them to have record keepers, somebody who would be doing more than just activism, more than rebuilding a church camp. And so I needed a couple of voices like that, and they just appeared. This would be natural that they would turn up. Their histories, I had to go ahead and augment them and create them, but some of that, too, they just told me what their history was. And so those characters in particular are kind of this younger generation. They are both the boys are both characters that who have not witnessed any of the original events and so are more free to elaborate on them through their own imaginations, which Darren certainly does. And Sally was a character who was in the origin. She was a kind of nonentity in that. She was a young high school kid and not very hip, but then found her way into my story and began telling me what it was all about.
Well, I wish we had more time. Maybe you have to come back and talk with us about electronic literature, because a lot of people don't know about it. Robert Coover is one of the founders of the Electric Literature Organization, has actually taught electronic writing, mixed media, including cave writing. Good to have you with us, though. So pleased to have you on the air with us.
Well, thank you very much, Michael.
And that's, by the way, writing is created in a digital environment, often intended to be read or viewed on a computer. When we return, Catherine Mott.